The pages flapped. On the last page, there was no photograph. A sheet of paper had been glued in with a streak of mucilage. The mucilage had crystallized into sugary brown grains. The paper had been turned on its side and glued horizontally to fit in the album. It was a mimeographed page torn from some kind of typed newsletter, yellow as the filter cotton of a cigarette butt. Rusty vampire bite of a stapler. Ink deepened to a bruised black shade of purple. Before my mother slammed the album shut, I had time to glimpse the words lunch menu, crabapple garnish, poet's corner, and my grandmother's name, all typed in the refined-looking 12-pitch size they used to call elite. "Well, shit," said my mother. "Did they fall out?" "I don't know. Were they in there before? When did you see them last?"
"I don't know."
My mother clutched the album to her chest. I could see that she was running through the recent history of the album's whereabouts and movements, trying to work her way back to the last time she had seen it intact. She looked stricken. I was surprised. Anyone would have been upset by such a loss, naturally. I just would have expected my mother to try to hide her distress.
"I don't know," she repeated.
She put down the album, got up from the couch, and went downstairs to the sewing room where I was staying. In the closet by the daybed where I slept, she kept the few old things, souvenirs, that she had held on to. She had always been the kind of woman who kept her balloon aloft and sailing by cutting away sandbags and throwing non-essentials over the side. Her years spent among the karmic adventurers of the East Bay lent an aura of liberation from the chains of Maya to her habit of discarding the evidence of her passage through the world. But it was not that. Sometimes, if she had an extra glass of wine, she might tell her current boyfriend or whomever she was living with that during her years on the loose with Uncle Ray, she had learned to travel light, so that it was time to make a dash for it. There would be nothing to trip you up or hold you down. At this point, the current boyfriend was likely to sense a metaphorical drift in the conversation and consider himself warned. But it was not that, either. My mother's lack of attachment to the past and its material embodiments went deeper than principle, training, or metaphor. It was an unbreakable habit of loss. "Nope," she said. "God damn it." She had been crouching in the closet's doorway, searching the shelves of a wire rack that also held her box of 45s, and an old Carmen Miranda doll whose fruit hat said Havana. She had searched the floor underneath the rack, lifted the lids on her boxes of buttons and rickrack, rifled the banker's box that held all her patterns from Butterick and Simplicity. Now she sank down and sat on the floor. She pulled her knees to her chest. She covered her face with her hands. "I guess they're still at Daddy's," she theorized in a calm tone of voice from behind her hands. In the storage space, the album was just in a box. The pictures were probably at the bottom. I should have checked. I should have dug around. "I'm sure they're there," I said. "You can get them next time." Now I understood why I'd never seen the album. It must have been buried in my grandparents' storage space at the Skyview, then followed my grandfather along with a whole lot of other crap to Florida. When she'd gone to collect her father at Fontana Village, my mother had brought the album back to Oakland. I wondered why she had wanted it, and if, were I to ask her, she would be able to tell me. "But, Mike, I mean, God knows when they fell out," she said. "It could have been years ago." "Ugh." She was still hiding her face behind the screen of her fingers. "I just feel sick."
"Mom, it's okay."
"I'm so sorry."
"They're just pictures. Pictures get lost."
It was the kind of thing she would have said. And I knew it would not strike her as callous or unsympathetic, but I did not believe it myself. It made my heart ache to think that the only known pictures of my grandmother's life before the war had been lost. But I wasn't going to tell her anything like that. "You're right," she said. "Obviously I haven't missed them before. Why should I care now?" She lowered her hands and sat up straight, as if she had recovered from the shock. "I just really wanted to show you," she said. She started, tentatively, to cry.
"Oh, Mom," I said. I waited. I had not seen my mother cry since the days when my father was busy setting fire to our lives. I didn't know how to console her, or if she even wanted to be or could be consoled. She had given very few clues over the years to help me understand how she felt about the things that she had lost in her lifetime.
"How about some tea?" I said.
"That might be nice, but I don't want to have trouble sleeping. I got some decaf Earl Grey at the Lucky."
"All right."
She wiped her eyes with the cuff of a nightgown sleeve. "I'll have some decaf Earl Grey." I went to the kitchen to put a kettle on. On the way, I passed the guest room and heard the click of knitting needles. Lola, the night nurse, was a big knitter. She was knitting me a remarkably hideous pair of argyle socks in the colors of the Philippine flag, which for years afterward I considered to be my lucky socks, right up to the day they disappeared. I made a pot of tea. My mother came in and sat down at the kitchen table, carrying the glass of scotch. She poured the whiskey into a teacup and then topped it off with tea from the pot. The photo album lay between us. I opened it to its first page, the four empty frames with their French inscriptions.
"Show me anyway," I said.
"What do you mean?"
"Describe them."
"I can't describe things," she said. "I don't have that."
"Please," I said, "just tell me what used to be there."
She closed her eyes and then reopened them, angling her head to one side, eyeing the page with a sidelong gaze of reminiscence. She pointed to the first empty space over the label that said, "Mare." "This one was my grandmother," she said. "Her name was Sarah. They called her Sally. Sally." She was standing on a street. There was a car behind her, part of a car, an old-fashioned, I don't know, the fender kind of went like this. She drew a swooping sine wave in the air.
"A roadster?"
I had recently been reading A Sport and a Pastime, set in post-war France, and could not help anachronistically picturing its hero's low-slung 1952 Delage.
"A convertible?"
"You couldn't see the roof. Maybe you could see a big brick building behind her with no windows, or not many. Maybe that was the tannery, I don't know. My grandmother had on a knee-length wool skirt and a fitted jacket, tapered at the waist, with wide lapels and epaulets. Clothes she could describe. She had sewn her own for years, until overseas manufacture made doing so more expensive than buying ready-made. Harris tweeds, maybe, very English-looking, and a hat with a broad brim and a little ornamental bird on it." She touched the side of her head where the bird on a broad-brimmed hat would have perched.
"You mean like a stuffed bird? A real bird?"
"I always assumed it was real."
"Why would anyone want to have a dead bird on their hat?"
"You walk around all the time with a dead cow on your feet." The spiked tea, or the exercise of memory, seemed to be helping. My mother jabbed the empty space above the label that said, "Pear." "This was my grandfather, Maurice. He was dark, heavy. He had a mustache, and glasses, little round ones." The picture was posed, taken indoors. Not a snapshot. It was taken in the studio. The photographer's name was on the picture here, Daumarier, like the writer.
"In Lille?"
"Yes." She moved her finger down to the bottom right corner of the empty space. "He was wearing a pinstripe suit and a tie pin with a little chain. I remember thinking that he didn't look like a very nice man. Neither of them looked very nice or very warm. Actually, they scared me. But I was ashamed to feel that because they had been killed by Hitler. It seemed
disloyal."
"Yes, I get that." It was rare for my mother to play a hand of memory with cards that the war and its brutalities had dealt her. But when she did, regardless of what was lying face up on the table, the whole card always seemed to be guilt. It was like if I didn't love them or even feel like I wished I had known them, if I didn't feel like I missed them even though I never met them, then somehow that had something to do with why they died,
like it was my fault. Like I thought what I did now, I mean when I was a kid, did have an effect on what happened then.
I recall that Benjamin and his thesis on the philosophy of history had a good deal to say about the past and the dead and their redemption in the present by the living. I let it go. My mother probably knew as much about the subject as Walter Benjamin.
I always thought it must have something to do with the tannery, my mother said. How angry and unhappy they looked, living in the midst of all that awfulness all the time, the blood, the carcasses, the stench.
She shuddered.
Can you imagine?
I don't know. I've never been to a tannery.
Neither have I, my mother said. I can imagine it anyway.
I know your mom hated it, I said. I mean, according to Grandpa. He said that was part of the thing with the skinless whores.
Huh.
My mother closed her eyes again, and this time when she reopened them, the candle of remembrance seemed to have been snuffed.
He told you about that.
It was less a question than a realization of how far out of his accustomed sea roads my grandfather had elected to sail. I admitted that he had said a fair amount about the skinless whores, particularly in describing events leading up to the burning of the tree.
That's something I don't think about, she said.
She was not making an observation. She was stating a rule. I pointed to the third empty rectangle on the page. Tell me about this one.
This was a picture of me sitting on a stone bench at the convent. I was 2, but I still had no hair, just a little baby hair. It hadn't come in. Somebody, I guess my mother, had put me in some kind of dirndl thing over a blouse with a Peter Pan collar. It was a terrible picture. I looked upset and uncomfortable.
And ugly. The three U's.
I look like this.
She furrowed her brow and pursed her lips. Her whole face seemed to collapse angrily around her nose. I laughed out loud.
I was the ugliest baby in the world.
No.
That picture I don't mind losing. Now, this one. This was...
Her voice slowed and thickened as she pointed to the remaining empty space on the page.
A picture of my mother and me. Obviously, I was a littler in this one. Only an infant in a little white sleeper. She was holding me on her lap in a wooden chair in a garden. A vegetable garden. Things growing on stakes. Tomatoes, raspberries, I don't know, peas. It was a, you know, a bent wood chair.
She traced the bell curve of a chair back.
She was looking into the camera and pointing it out to me, telling me to look at the camera, smiling.
My mother was smiling at the memory.
She had a real light in her eyes.
She was beautiful.
She was.
Her tone shifted. She sounded almost disappointed in me.
But I think she let it define her a little too much. It was the only thing she really liked about herself.
My mother was beautiful, too, though not in the same way as her mother. She was dark, where my grandmother had been fair and freckled. Her nose long and straight, where my grandmother's had been upturned. Long-legged, where my grandmother had been petite. I knew my mother regarded her own good looks and the social benefit they had afforded over the years as a kind of cheat or ambiguous grace. They often came in handy, but they were a source of recurrent trouble. They were nothing of which she could be proud.
Well, I said. I had never heard my mother criticize her mother even in such tempered terms.
I knew she felt there were grounds for criticism, but I did not know how I knew it, since she had never said anything about it. It was just a kind of weather in the house from time to time. I mean, there are worse things to like about yourself.
I guess, I don't know. She was overly concerned with appearances, with how things looked, how they seemed, what people would think and say about her. She heard voices, and they used to say awful, just horrible things about her. On the outside she was beautiful, but on the inside she felt ugly, she felt ruined. And she was so afraid of having that come out.
I was near breaking the rule about mentioning the skinless horse, but caught myself in time.
I turned the page. There was a picture of Uncle Ray and the Zoftig woman with the hard eyes. Mrs. Einstein? Mrs. E. A picnic table in some forgotten park outside Baltimore. Sandwiches wrapped in paper. Bottles of White Rock and National Bohemian on the picnic table. Uncle Ray sitting down with his legs crossed at the knee, wearing slacks, a knit polo shirt, two-tone loafers without socks. Mrs. Einstein stationed behind him, standing in a sleeveless summer dress that clung to the ample splendor she retained. Uncle Ray, smiling. Mrs. E., almost smiling. The fingers of her right hand rested all but imperceptibly on his right shoulder. "Hey, were they?" My mother pursed her lips. She looked innocently at the ceiling. "Oh, my God," I said. "I so knew it." She was really in love with him. Uh-oh. Your voice got all filled with doom. "Well, he broke her heart." She shook her head. "Fucking Raynard." Her tone was not entirely lacking in affection. He was charming and fun, but he was a liar and a cheater and a dog. He was as bad as your father. Better in some ways, worse in others. Don't you be like him. "Okay," I said. I knew that I could not have been that kind of man if I had devoted half of every day to the effort. Part of me never wanted to be anything else. "He broke my heart, too." She might have been talking to herself. "What?" I said. I felt myself sinking into the lunar sofa that was the last thing my parents had purchased together before my father's disappearance. As a boy of the 1970s, I had stood by and watched as my mother, like some patriotic young hothead after Fort Sumter or Pearl Harbor, had enlisted in the Corps of Liberated Women. Among those who served under that banner, openness was held to be the consequence and not just the precondition of adventure. I had heard a thing or two during those years that shocked me. In time, I grew used to and even began to look forward to, I suppose, being shocked. Around the time of Reagan's election, however, my mother had settled down. I was out of practice. She sat there pie-eyed with her mouth hanging open. After a minute, I realized that she was imitating me. I closed my mouth. "You didn't, you know, sleep with Uncle Ray, right?" I said. "He wasn't that much older than me, or it never seemed like he was." She tipped the teacup of scotch to drain whatever was left in it. "Anyway, he wasn't really my uncle." "Still," I said. "I mean, Mom, you were a minor. You were a kid." "True," my mother said, refastening the clasp that sealed up the black and white planet of her girlhood and other lost things. "It was a crime." Her voice held bitterness and affection. The man was definitely a criminal. "Did he?" "There was alcohol involved. To be honest, I don't really remember much. But I guess I must not have been too happy about it, because the next day I shot him in the eye."
"You what?"
"With a bow and arrow."
"Were you sitting on a horse at the time?"
"I told him I didn't want that photographer taking my picture," she said.
"Damn, Mom."
I pictured Uncle Ray in a pair of Bermudas and a Guayabera shirt, reeling across a hotel lawn with his hands cupped around the shaft of the arrow that was sticking out of his face. I guess I was angry. I guess at that point I was angry about everything. I felt the cold bite of the arrowhead, a burst of red in my left eye. I shuddered.
"I know," said my mother.
"Well," I said in a more philosophical tone, I was over the shock of it now, and the more I thought about her act of retaliation, the less it surprised me. Uncle Ray had a reputation for shrewdness, but he must not have understood my mother very well, or he would never have led her anywhere near a bow and arrow.
"I mean, you kind of got seriously fucked over."
"I got a head start on fucked over," my mother said. "Then your dad kind of finished me off."
"Same here."
I held up my hand palm outward, and after a moment she gave me a soft high five.
"But I can't have been that angry at your grandpa," she said.
"Or I would have told him about me and Ray, and I never did."
"Maybe you didn't need to."
"You think he knows?"
"There's five things he brings with him from Florida. That picture is one of them."
I thought that was a little weird. Maybe Ray confessed at some point.
Maybe knowing you shot Uncle Ray with an arrow made Grandpa feel a little better about his word abandoning you with him.
That is the correct word.
I guess it kind of showed that you knew how to, like, handle yourself.
Hmm, she said. She put a hand on my arm. Still, just in case, don't tell him, okay? Maybe that was the only picture he could find. We didn't have much time to pack.
Okay, I said. I won't tell him that I know that you know that he knows what everybody wants to talk about.
What's the point of talking about it? My mother said. Everybody already knows.
Chapter 30 They arrived too late for lunch, and whatever part of it had been garnished with slices of crabapple. It was early September 1958. The afternoon lay gray and heavy over Morristown. The east was a lustrous pile of thunderheads. To the west loomed Greystone Park, another thunderhead massed against the sky. Lightning flickered in the periphery of my grandfather's vision, but when he looked straight on at the clouds, it was never there. He wondered if this furtive lightning might be happening inside him and not over downtown Newark. He had not seen, held, or fucked my grandmother in 14 months. And despite the sullen presence of their teenage daughter beside him in the car, his thoughts for the past hour or more had been of the plum of my grandmother's lower lip between his teeth, of the down on her ass, of reaching around to cup her breasts as he entered her from behind, of burying his nose in the cool, salt parting of her hair as she lay with her head on his chest, and a leg jackknifed across his abdomen. He was at the wheel of a 1958 Buick Riviera purchased on Broadway 3 days before for a little over $3,000 cash. Its engine boomed up the green tunnel of elms that lined the road into Morristown. In the hip pocket of his new slacks were $500 bills, 9 50s, 2 20s, and a change of a 10. My grandfather's underwear, shirt, socks, shoes, belt, wristwatch, and money clip were as new as the slacks. He had considered buying a suit, but had opted instead for 2 pair of slacks, chocolate and dark navy, and a tropical weight worsted sport coat and a muted gold windowpane plaid. Pale peach shirt worn without a tie, collar open. He was a free man with money in his pocket and a new hard-top coupe. He was the new-minted managing partner of MRX Incorporated, with Sam Shaven for a partner and principal investor and a contract to supply Shaven Scientific with 5,000 1-to-20 scale solid-fueled aerobie high rockets. Even the bottled voltage of desire for my grandmother was a source of pleasure as it lit up his brain. He had never come closer in his life to something he was prepared to call happiness. But at the moment, there was one set of Y-coordinates keeping my grandfather asymptotically from intersecting with that untouchable X-axis. "Could you please just attempt to drive normally?" my mother said. "I'm going the speed limit."
"You might be averaging the speed limit, but you keep doing that thing where you tap the gas, take your foot off. Fast, slow, fast, slow, fast." My mother made a fist of her right hand and pushed it forward, pulled it back. There was an unsettling likeness in this gesture to the recent trend of his thoughts. He felt apprehended. "It's like you are trying to make me vomit."
"I'm sorry," he said. "I won't do it anymore."
Her head was tilted back against the headrest, and she had her eyes closed. She sat wedged against the passenger door, hugging her knees in their stiff dungarees to her chest, her ankles under rolled cuffs, a tale of summer written by sticker bushes, mosquitoes, and fingernails. The soles of her blue Sperry boat shoes had printed a moire of wavelets and white dust on the oxblood leather seat. Back in the new apartment he'd rented in Parkchester, on the new bed with a pink chenille spread, a sleeveless gingham sundress, guaranteed by a Macy's sales clerk to be universally desirable to girls of 16, lay untried beside a pair of open-toed flats still in their box. She had not even taken the dress off its hanger. Like everything he said and did, it appeared to revolt her. The first thing she had said to him after they'd gotten the preliminary inanities out of the way was, I thought you were supposed to be there longer.
He had explained that because of his spotless record, bearing only the invisible spots of an accidental homicide and violating curfew with an exploit in the walls, his new partner, who did business with the Department of Corrections, had been able to put in a good word for him and help win him early release. Later that day, my grandfather had taken my mother to see the new offices of MRX. He had leased half a floor in a 10-year-old building on Cortland Street downtown, a couple of blocks from the Aero radio shop he had managed in the mid-50s. When they got there, Uncle Sammy was just giving a tour of the premises to his brother and his nephew, a dark-eyed, good-looking kid, crown prince of his family, not yet 20, and already in medical school. His small stature, smart clothes, lustrous fingernails, and something indefinable, maybe he just looked like a hustler, reminded my grandfather of Ray, before the mysterious eye patch, of course. What was the story there? The shaven kid had that Renardian way of looking inattentive when he was measuring someone, in this case my mother, to the millimeter. My mother returned my father's attentive inattention with a display of her skill at striking unposed poses. After 5 minutes, they had slipped out without anyone noticing. My grandfather found them out on a fire escape, smoking and just talking. Despite rulings handed down over the centuries by our sages concurring that handsome young medical students be given the benefit of the doubt, my grandfather could not help being annoyed. "You didn't even see the testing room," he had complained afterward. "You didn't see the wind tunnel." "It smelled like old peanuts in there," my mother had replied. He had deposited with his brother for safekeeping a girl who smelled of Life Boy and library paste, and retrieved a young woman who smelled of cigarettes and ban. He did not blame Ray for this alteration, however, for this strange and gawky changeling with her big bust and her eyes passing merciless judgment on everything they settled upon apart from lapdogs and babies. He did not simply attribute the change in my mother to the glandular inevitability of adolescent rebellion. He knew that he was responsible. His failure to control his own anger on that day in the offices of Feathercombs Incorporated was the source of the anger that seeped out of her every time she spoke to him or looked at him. In the 37 hours they had spent together since their reunion at the Schraffs on Fordham Road, he had managed to keep them out of an outright argument. But there had been these regular low-level discharges, a plasma of anger that seemed to cling to her like St. Elmo's fire. Maybe that, he thought, was the flickering at the corner of his eye. "Why do you make me eat all that food?" "You have to eat."
"I do eat, just not breakfast. Uncle Ray never eats breakfast either."
"Most important meal of the day."
"I told you my stomach can't handle food in the morning."
He had attempted to surprise her on their way down from the Bronx with breakfast at the Howard Johnson's he remembered her having loved so much a couple of years before. It had not been his intention to cajole and then effectively coerce her into eating a short stack of chocolate chip pancakes, but that was the way it had worked out. "I know, honey, you did. I'm sorry."
"I said I only wanted coffee."
"And a cigarette."
"Oh, a horror," said my mother. "Oh, the everlasting shame."
My grandfather was still compiling an inventory of all the unwelcome changes in his daughter wrought during her 13 months under his brother's careless care. Sarcasm and smoking headed the list so far. As they turned into the hospital's parking lot, the sun broke through the clouds and lent a confectionery splendor to the heaped-up arches and swags of Greystone Park. It was not a regular visiting day, and he found a spot close to the grand steps of the central building. He cut the engine. The clack of sprinklers filled the car. The wide, empty lawns were veiled in shifting iridescence. One of the rivulets in the flow of his imaginings that morning had been the sight of my grandmother rising to her feet on the topmost step of the main building, in the belted navy blue dress she had been wearing the last time he'd seen her. She had lifted a tentative hand, then dropped it and come tearing down the steps toward him. He would burst from the Buick, leaving the engine running and the door open, and go to her. She would leap into his arms and scissor her legs around his waist. The contact of their mouths would be the fixed point around which the world, the day,
and the state hospital would rotate. The steps were empty. My mother lowered her chin and opened her eyes. She took a pack of Marlboro cigarettes from her handbag and put one between her lips. They were tipped with red paper to hide the print of a lady's lipstick. But my grandfather had succeeded, by dint of pleading that rapidly turned abject, in persuading my mother to leave her face unpainted, just for today, until they had all had a chance to adjust. "I already adjusted," she had said flatly. Automatically, he took Allenbaugh's lighter from his pocket and lit my mother's cigarette, then averted his face so he would not have to see how adeptly she handled the business of smoking it. She made a virtuous show of directing her smoke out the window of the Riviera. My grandfather saw that the cigarette was trembling in her fingers. "How is she, really?" my mother said. "Please don't say, 'We'll have to see.'" As repeated by my mother, the words hung from the hooks of ironizing quotation marks. But my grandfather could find no weak points in the assessment. "Did they shock her?" "Who told you that, Ray?" She nodded. She was crying. He reached for her, but she pushed him away. She jabbed at the cigarette lighter, pulled it out, and before he could stop her, touched the heating element with the tip of her index finger. "Real nice," she said. She poked the lighter back into its slot. "They sold you a broken car."
"They did not shock her," he said. He was reasonably certain that this was the case. "As far as I can tell, the only thing they did is give her some hormones."
Over the phone, the doctor had said that a year ago my grandmother had gone into early menopause, with a consequent intensification of her symptoms. They had tried a new treatment, a drug just on the market called Premarin. "I don't know," my mother said. "I mean, if she's how she is because of the things that happened to her in her life, it seems like you would have to shock it out of her somehow." My grandfather said he didn't know much about electric shock therapy, but he didn't really think that was how it worked. "Look at that place," my mother said, staring up through the windows at the battlements of Greystone. "Ugh, I can't go in. I don't want to see her in there. You go in, okay, and get her, and I'll wait in the car. Please? Dad, I'm sorry I've been such a pill. I want to see Mama, but I don't want to go in there." My grandfather reached for the dashboard lighter. He did not want to force my mother to have to see her mother in a madhouse, and he did not want my grandmother to walk out of the madhouse after 11 months and see him standing there alone. He could not decide which of the two would represent the bigger failure on his part. He brought his fingertip near the element and felt the heat of it well before he let it touch his skin. There was a hiss, and the car filled with a nauseous odor like the smell of a tooth under the drill. "Fixed," he said. He moved the car to a shaded parking space and rolled the windows down. He got out of the car and slammed the door. He was almost to the steps leading up to the front doors of Greystone when he heard the scrape of her topsiders against the pavement behind him. At the bottommost step he turned, and she was standing there. They looked up at the high oak doors entangled in vines of wrought iron and shared a moment of awe, or dread, or at the very least hesitation. He felt like he ought to take her hand. He felt that he wanted to. But he was afraid that when he reached for her, as on the day they first met, she would turn him down and leave him with his hand stuck out. He was still trying to decide if he could risk the disappointment when he felt the butterfly flutter of her fingers against his palm. A woman wearing a white cardigan and white tennis shoes came out of the reception office on the far side of a sliding pane of glass. The glass was veined with wire mesh. She was not a nurse, but her short white hair had the upswept wings of a nurse's hat. She asked my grandfather to wait in the lobby for the doctor, Medved, who had been treating my grandmother. Everything was fine in the way of my grandmother's recovery, and not to worry. There was some aspect of her care that the doctor wanted to discuss. "Come, dear," she said to my mother. "I'll take you along to the theater." Her kindly manner was lost on my mother, who, on entering the lobby of the hospital, had awakened like a sleepwalker on a roof to find herself one step shy of an abyss. She was afraid to move. She remembered a scene from a movie she had seen in which a soldier trod on a landmine that would detonate only if he lifted his foot. She was afraid to speak, listen, or breathe. The lobby was very grand. It was framed by a double stairway rising to a colonnaded mezzanine. It had a crystal chandelier, a chessboard of marble for a floor and masked by pine sol and narcissi in pots, a bloom of human feces in the air. I don't want to go to the theater. I'm just here to get my mom.
Your mother is in the theater, sweetie, the woman said. It's dress rehearsal for the play. She has been very involved.
But we're taking her home today, my grandfather said.
Oh, yes, she knows that.
My grandfather was hurt, and his face must have shown it. The pity on the woman's face was plain to see.
She only learned you were coming the other day, isn't that right? Did she know what time you two would be arriving today?
I must have forgotten to tell her, my grandfather said. He had sent a telegram which might have gone astray, but he did not want this woman feeling sorry for him. He looked at his watch. The doctor had been promised in 5 and no more than 10 minutes hence. He gave my mother a curt nod. Go ahead. My mother failed to take the cue. She was staring at something with an expression of uneasiness. My grandfather put a hand on her shoulder and followed her gaze. Expecting some ruin of a patient, shuffling head down, fingernails like guitar picks, he knew one instant of raw panic that the thing she was staring at, frozen in place, eyebrows furrowed, was my grandmother. But when he turned, he saw that my mother appeared simply to be staring at the wall.
What's wrong?
Nothing,
my mother said unconvincingly.
Come, dear,
the woman in the white cardigan said again. This time she took hold of my mother's elbow and pulled her gently toward a wide doorway between the stairways. She told my grandfather,
Please, have a seat. Dr. Medved won't be long.
My grandfather sat down in a harbor chair by the front door, watching as my mother was led away. He stood up again and called out,
Excuse me.
The woman in the white cardigan stopped and looked back at him.
Yes?
What is the play?
I really couldn't tell you that, said the woman. I can't make head or tail out of any of it.
The woman introduced herself as Mrs. Outcault. Between the entry hall and the theater, at the far end of a long series of alternating left and right turns through one of the hospital's lightning bolt-shaped wings, she punctuated the void of my mother's silence with bursts of hospital history and lore. She had a 16-year-old daughter of her own, she said. She knew the type of thing a girl my mother's age most wanted to hear about. If they passed a patient with an interesting biography or symptomology, narcolepsy, a pathological fear of hats, an inability to recognize danger, the folk singer Mr. Guthrie, she divulged it. She told my mother that the hospital had a theater because of the opinions of a wealthy man named Adolf Hill, a manufacturer of necktie silk from Patterson. It was Mr. Hill's belief that the ancient Greeks had been the sanest men who ever lived. This was due, Hill further believed, to the greatness of Greek drama, which allowed audiences and actors alike to face the frightful things inside and outside their skulls. When in time Hill's wife was committed to Greystone, Hill had endowed construction of the Adolph and Millicent Hill Theater. It was not true, Mrs. Outcault said, that Hill deliberately arranged to have his wife committed in order to put his theories about drama therapy to the test. But it was possible that Mr. Hill's theorizing was the thing that had driven poor Millicent insane. Around 1927, she had hanged herself in her room, not in the theater, thank goodness, by stringing together 3 neckties made from Empire Silk Company's finest stock. Outside the theater doors on a settee of tufted leather sat an old man in a green 3-piece suit cut from a coarse, textured fabric, the color of lederhosen and piped at the lapels and buttonholes, in a paler shade of artichoke heart. He was sitting very erect, with his hands on his knees. The lily of a pocket square peeped from the breast pocket of his jacket. He seemed to be studying the opposite wall with surprising intensity, given the fact that it was a blank expanse of beige. He did not look over or break off his study of the blank wall until Mrs. Outcault reached out to touch his shoulder. "Arthur! Arthur!" He started, flinched, and cried out in a voice like a rusty pump.
"Oh, I always spook him," Mrs. Outcault said.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Casamonica." She clasped her hands together at her breast and looked deeply sorry.
"Mr. Casamonica wrote the play."
Mr. Casamonica lurched to his feet and made another sound that did not form itself into a word or words. He smiled. He was long-shanked, and before gravity had bent him to its purpose, might have been tall once. Inside the green suit he was mostly skeleton. His palm against my mother's was powdery and cool.
"How are you?"
Mrs. Outcault said very loudly. Mr. Casamonica nodded genially and made a looping benedictory gesture in the air just in front of his face, more ornate than a cross, as if he were a priest in a sect whose symbol was the holy coat-hanger of God.
"Sign language," Mrs. Outcault explained. "Poor things, deaf as a boot. I heard he was struck by lightning, though I can't say for sure."
With his long, pallid fingers and his nails manicured to a moon-like luster, Mr. Casamonica continued to draw things across the space between him and my mother. The regular rippling of a corrugated roof, the outline of a jellyfish, the downward spiral of water in a toilet bowl. Mrs. Outcault nodded emphatically.
"Oh, yes," she said. "I know, you're so right."
"What's he saying?"
"I have no idea,"
Mrs. Outcault said through a tight smile. She kept on nodding.
"It isn't real sign language at all, just something he made up. He never learned to speak English very well, and in the past few years, he's lost the ability to read and write in Italian."
"He... then how did he write a play?"
"He dictated it to your mother, which is why she has been so involved in all this, using those crazy signs of his."
"My mom doesn't know any sign language."
"Apparently she is fluent in Mr. Casamonica's."
My mother watched Mr. Casamonica's hands and fingers explain the behavior of skyrockets, the opening of a can of beer, and the proper means for setting a golf ball on a tee.
"It looks like he's just making it up as he goes along," she said. "That is a popular theory," said Mrs. Outcault.
Dr. Medved's head was a thumb upthrust from his shirt collar. Blue ink stain of chin stubble, white lab coat worn over a summer suit the color of a manila folder, purple bow tie, barrel-chested with a heavy gut, the body of a dock worker belied or redeemed by framed diplomas from NYU and the Tulane School of Medicine. He winced as he belayed himself into the swivel chair behind his desk. His face suggested gas pain, a hemorrhoid, maybe both. The chair's steel joints creaked. Its spring uncoiled with a clang of metal fatigue.
"As I told you, there has been marked improvement," Dr. Medved said.
As in the course of their brief phone conversation, there was something off in the doctor's tone, a hint of hedging or doubt. Or maybe it was only chronic heartburn. Medved set down the paper cup of water he had stopped to fill from the cooler outside his office. He yanked open a drawer in his desk and found a bottle of bromo-seltzer. He unscrewed the bottle, dropped two tablets into the cup of water, and unbent a paperclip before he seemed to notice that my grandfather had yet to reply. He stirred the cup with the paperclip, looking up at my grandfather from under his wide nib eyebrows.
"Anything you want to say to that?"
Ordinarily, my grandfather distrusted Jews who wore bow ties. But something about Medved, probably the paperclip, inclined him to make an exception.
"Naturally, I'm relieved to hear it," my grandfather said. "But you've been relieved before, of course, I understand. I have to tell you, though, a future setback, a relapse, should one occur, it won't in any way invalidate your present feelings of relief."
"In my experience, Doc, with all due respect, I beg to differ." Dr. Medved nodded. Tablets hissed and chuckled in the cup. He picked it up and glugged it down. He held up a finger, begging my grandfather's indulgence for 1 minute, then curled the hand into a fist that he pressed against his abdomen under the rib cage.
His expression grew thoughtful, searching. He let out a belch that was low and resonant, a sustained note drawn across the strings of a cello. He ducked his head shyly and smiled an embarrassed little smile.
"Ooh, boy."
"Mazel tov."
"Forgive me," he said. "Lunch was rather heavy. Now, listen. You hear me say improvement. I understand you may have some reason to be skeptical. Improvement is measured at a scale so much finer, more incremental than calamity, isn't it? And it's perfectly normal to feel apprehension about a loved one's return to so-called civilization. As a general rule, when it comes to the families, I encourage efforts to keep expectations low, to minimize the impact of the inevitable disappointment."
This was more or less a précis of my grandfather's approach to existence itself. Hearing Medved formulated, and in this particular context, undid a string long knotted inside him.
"I think I can do that," he said.
Chapter 31. She hangs back in the dark of the little theater. The bright stage under the proscenium reminds her of something she saw once in a Stuart Granger movie, a bonfire blazing in the maw of a stone god. She seems to be seeing faces everywhere today. Maybe she ought to take her mother's place here in this creepy joint. Above the proscenium, two more faces, masks representing the poles of mania. A woman in a golden-black striped leotard looks out from the wings, her painted face as hectic as a ballerina's. A fat man in a bathrobe plays glassy ostinatos on a Wurlitzer organ, shards of waltz from some half-familiar hole. Rocking back and forth on the bench, wildly out of tempo with his music. Later she will learn that the fat man was really a fat woman. There is something awful about this cave of make-believe with its smell of velvet and dust. It has the magic weirdness of the old amusement halls on Uncle Ray's nine-ball circuit, the back rooms beyond the pool tables and pinball machines. The penny catacombs of entertainment, live chickens and glass music boxes that dance when subjected to mild electrocution through the feet. Coin-operated beheadings of tiny queens, lynchings of tiny clockwork Negroes. A life-size little Egypt automaton enacting a creaky seizure of a hoochie-coochie dance. A clockwork Lucifer with a clockwork leer who makes predictions about your love life in racy slang rendered incomprehensible by time. She stands, unnerved, by the bright mouth of the stage as if it is about to render prophecy. "It's all right," the woman in the white cardigan says. "Do you see your mother, sweetheart?"
"No."
Here and there among the seats, she sees the outlined heads of other people in the audience, but none of them is right. She cannot imagine and will never discover the nature or identities of these other people. Doctors, attendants, Napoleons, and mothers of Christ. She hears the clunk of a switch. In the sudden total dark, a ghostly half-moon slews across her retina. The light come up again on a field of clover. Trefoil hands, faces uplifted toward a shiny sun that hangs above their spiky pink and white heads. A swarm of fat-bottomed bees careen in and out among the flowers. Wordlessly, they quarrel with the flowers. They dip into the flowers' faces with the bowls of big wooden spoons. George Washington appears, dressed in knee-breeches, a powdered wig, a great coat, hatchet slung from his belt. He stomps around abusing the flowers and exhorting the bees to molest them for their nectar. This is not George Washington, it turns out, but a herdsman of bees. The purpose or significance of the hatchet, apparently not intended for the chopping down of a cherry tree, remains unclear. The bee herder watches contentedly as his bees fly back and forth with their ladles full of nectar from the looted flowers to their unseen hive. All of this is routine for the bee herder. He lounges on a hummock and fights to stay awake. The sun, with its metallic glow, goes down. Evening hoists a silvery moon into the heavens.
A pair of bears, unseen by the bee herder, shamble on from stage left. They swing their heads in unison from side to side as they advance. They are shabby-looking bears, a couple of ruffians with patchy coats. They observe the traffic and nectar. When the bee herder's back is turned, they accost the plumpest of his bees. They threaten it with violence and confiscate its wooden spoon. With bearish ardor, they guzzle up every drop. At last, the cries of the assaulted bee attract the attention of the drowsing bee herder. He leaps to his feet and throws his silver hatchet at the bears. But instead of striking them, it just keeps rising, all the way to the moon overhead, where it lodges with a soft thump, like a dictionary falling onto a pillow. The bee herder studies the problem. He fidgets with his wig. Then he remembers his rope. He makes a lariat, swings it over his head with an audible whir, and then launches the loop toward the hatchet with its handle protruding from the moon. The loop misses the handle, and the rope falls back to earth. He windmills it and launches it moonward again. This time the eye of the rope snags the wooden handle. He gives it a tug and then starts to pull himself up the rope hand over hand. Bees, bears, and flowers raise their heads and gawp in amazement. The bee herder climbs unamazed. Darkness falls over the field of clover. Dawn breaks on the moon. Jagged moon mountains glow cool and silvery blue in the background as the bee herder, hatchet restored, strolls along unfazed by his new surroundings. He passes silver moon trees like the skeletons of cacti. He picks a bouquet of silver moon flowers. As he turns, he notices a small silver ball rolling toward his feet. A woman comes running in after it, but stops when she sees him. She wears a silver gown and a silver crown. A large pair of silver wings rise up behind her. A moth's wings, billowing gently in a lunar breeze. He picks up the ball, and for a moment they regard each other. Then he tosses her the ball, and she catches it. What befalls the bee herder and the queen of the moon after this first encounter, how the pantomime is meant to end, will remain forever unknown by my mother. The mountains of the moon, glowing under the light of a blue gel at the back of the stage, were tinfoil balls, massed and squashed into cake-frosting peaks. The moon trees were a couple of branching coat racks wrapped in more foil. Silver paper, my grandmother always called it. The moon flowers were clusters of egg beaters, whisks, and serving spoons planted in cake pans. It was all so ridiculous and sad. It was pathetic. And yet, the foil shone in the subaqueous light, the coat racks raising their jubilant arms and the bouquets of kitchen implements had the incongruous dignity of homely things. Looking into the radiant mouth of the stage, my mother felt a strong sense of recognition, as if she had visited this world in a dream, as if, when she was a child, the fog of her mother's dreams had rolled through the house every night and left this sparkling residue on her memory. There was no way the baffling history of a space-faring bee herder and his visit to the moon had been dictated to her mother in some kind of bogus hand symbology by poor old lightning-addled Mr. Casamonica. The Queen of the Moon entered, chasing the little ball of foil in her tinfoil dress and crown, and her wobbling wings made from nylon stretched over coat hangers and glued with sequins. This was not the moon at all. It was some other world, some other mother, uncharted and hitherto unknown. It was just the most beautiful thing, my mother told me. Then the bright glints seemed to startle from her the tinfoil crown and swarm the air between her mother and her, jigging and flittering until they all flew away and left her in the dark. She came to herself on the leather settee outside the theater door, sitting beside Mr. Casamonica, her nose rife with the smell of mothballs oozing from his suit. Mrs. Outcault crouched in front of her, frowning as if watching a doubtful cake through the window of an oven. Behind Mrs. Outcault stood a bear, three clovers, two bees, and the fat pianist in his bathrobe and slippers. Behind them stretched an expanse of wall covered in the same wallpaper that was in the entry hall, which my grandfather had caught her staring at without understanding why. The thing was that if you looked at the wallpaper one way, it was nothing special, a repeating pattern of carnation pink escutcheons with white rondelles, each shield supported by a pair of gold willow-leaf garlands. If you looked at the wallpaper another way, you were confronted by a crowd of bloody-mouthed faces, ass-eared and staring. "Here she is," Mrs. Outcault said. "You're fine, honey, aren't you?" My mother nodded, although she was not entirely sure. She averted her eyes from the wallpaper and found Mr. Casamonica beside her. He had his chin in the air and was looking down his long nose at her with an air of satisfaction and calm. "Don't worry," said his eyes. "Everything is unfolding just as I intended." "I enjoyed your play," my mother told him. In reply, Mr. Casamonica gravely unscrewed an invisible jar. My mother heard heels tapping, a rustling that was also a rattle. My grandmother came running into the small lobby, minus her wings, with her crown askew, pressing it against her head with one hand. Mrs. Outcault stood up, and everyone stepped back and looked at my grandmother except Mr. Casamonica, who seemed not to notice. My mother got up too fast. Her pulse drummed its fingers along the hinge of her jaw. "I'm sorry, Mom," my mother said. It was the first thing she could think of to say. My mother went to her mother, who slid her cool, bare arms alongside my mother's neck and scissored her between them. It was an awkward but sincere embrace. My mother's gaze strayed again to the wallpaper with its thousand gaping, long-eared faces, and my grandmother knew without following it what there was to see.
"You don't have to look," she said.
My mother turned her face from the wallpaper for good.
"You have been in prison," Dr. Medved said.
"Wall kill," my grandfather said. 13 months. For a violent crime." My grandfather had anticipated that from time to time, over the course of his life to come, he would be expected to give some account of events between August 1957 and September 1958. He would do so, he had decided, only when asked directly by someone who had a reasonable right to know. Employers, inevitably, though in his present situation, since he'd been recruited by Sam Shaven, who was filled in by the warden, on the very grounds of the prison, nothing had needed to be said. He would tell my grandmother about his time served, provided she asked. The details were nothing he felt the need to volunteer. As for my mother, what was it like in prison, had been among the few spontaneous questions aimed his way during their drive down from New York City. And she had seemed content, or, according to her version, she had been obliged to content herself with a one-word answer. Interesting. Beyond these moments, my grandfather had estimated that he was likely to be forced into, and had therefore budgeted, ballpark 3 to 5 discussions of his incarceration between now and the day he died. He decided to spend one of them now. "I attacked a man, my employer. I tried to strangle him with a telephone cord."
"I see. And what had he done to deserve such treatment?"
"Nothing," my grandfather said, "as far as I know."
"Ah," the doctor said. "And to provoke it?"
"I got fired."
"Ah."
"It was the day after the first time she tried to burn the tree. I was agitated."
"Because she had set fire to this tree after a period of more than a year?"
"Almost 2 years."
"During which her illness appeared largely to have disappeared. The hallucinations abated."
"Yes. Only looking back, I realized that it had been there all along. It's just that somehow we all managed to ignore it for a while.
And then it came charging back that night, in a great fiery rush. That must have been terrifying."
"It definitely seemed to invalidate the sense of relief, I'll tell you that."
"And the next day, the attack. How much of the anger that led you to try to strangle your employer do you feel was really misdirected anger toward your..."
"All of it. I didn't even really know the man."
Ah.
It wasn't her, exactly, I was angry at. I didn't blame her, and I don't now. I knew she couldn't